Hello, and welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. We are broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 on unceded ancestral territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Our hands are up again this week to our hosts. Thank you for letting us live and work on your beautiful territory. My name is Celia Joseph. I'm from Squamish and Nanaimo Nations, and I will be your semi-host today, doing the boards, and I'm sitting here with Kaylin Barr and David Gertner from FNSP, and they are going to be having a conversation about Indigenous New Media, so I'll let them introduce themselves.
Okay, I'll begin. Hi, I'm Kaylin Barr. I'm a settler Canadian, like Celia said, living on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples, and I am currently finishing my majors in anthropology, and I'm excited to be able to have a discussion with Dr. Dave Gertner today.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you both for having me in today. I'm a longtime CITR alum. This is my first time in the new studio, though. My name's Dave Gertner. I'm a settler scholar of German descent on both my mother and my father's side. And I've lived on in Coast Salish territory almost all of my life, except for a little time in Treaty 1, Kaylin and I were just talking about, when I was at the University of Manitoba. And I'm currently an assistant professor in the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program here at UBC. And I specialize in Indigenous New Media and Digital Storytelling, which is how I met both Celia and Kaylin in a course I teach there, Indigenous New Media. And I currently live on Musqueam territory with my wife and two lovely children. And we've been here for about 2 years. So that's enough about me for now.
I should give a little bit of background. There wasn't really a class like David's before he came and brought it to FNIS. And so I feel like after we took it in the first year that he offered it, our minds were all blown a little bit and we were really excited. And it led me to doing my practicum at CITR. As David said, he had been affiliated with them for years. And so he brought CITR to FNIS, First Nations and Indigenous Studies program, to be a practicum partner. And so I got placed with them, did my research project with them, and then that's kind of how I got this job here at CITR, coordinating the collective. So it's all come full circle now. So it's very exciting to bring David on the show, and there's nobody better than Kaylin to do this conversation with him. So I'm going to play you a song. We're going to do this interview, and then afterwards, we're going to let you know about some exciting events happening in the community this week and things for you to keep your eyes out for. So here is the song. Hello and welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. If you are just tuning in, this episode is an interview with David Gertner from the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program about his work within Indigenous New Media. We are broadcasting from CITR 101.9 from unceded ancestral Musqueam territories. So please, without further ado, Kaylin and David, and that was Uvagut by Northern Haze, which is an Inuit metal band.
Okay, let's get to it then. I think what I'd like to begin with is talking about maybe some of the disjunctures about what it means for me as a settler student to be interviewing you as a settler professor. Mm-hmm. And so my first question is going to be around how you negotiate the tensions and complexities of being a settler professor in the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program.
Yeah, it's a great question, and thanks for opening up with that, because I think it's an important thing for us to consider. In fact, I think it's one of my responsibilities as a white, straight, cis, able-bodied man in the academy is to draw attentions to the different structures of power that are in room in different places, just like you're beginning this interview by doing. I think because of the privilege that I have a lot of access to spaces that my colleagues in Indigenous Studies might not. And I try to use that power for good, I guess, particularly in the field of new media, which is perhaps not unsurprising to anyone, is still a very white, male-dominated field. So first, calling attention to those structures of power which are normalized in the academy or are considered to be normal. So even and can be difficult is sort of drawing attention to how those structures are playing out. So for instance, I was recently invited to a fairly prominent conference here at UBC, and the panel I was asked to be on was going to be all white dudes. And so I had to have, with very sweaty hands and anxiety, I had a meeting with the person organizing the panel and politely decline participating, drawing attention to why I was declining. And so a lot of the times I see my position is actually subtracting myself from the conversation and creating space for Indigenous speakers, particularly Indigenous women. The work I'm doing right now, I've been working with the Mohawk artist Skawanati for a long time and her work in Cyber Powwow and other venues. And the work I'm doing right now is attempting to clear some space for Skawanati and local artist and media developer Loretta Todd to show the very important role they've played in making space for Indigenous new media. So in the late 90s, when new media was all the rage or the internet was all the rage, we have two Indigenous women who, in fact, cut the terrain for this space. And that was in a time when the internet, despite the sort of utopic rhetoric that surrounded it, was exceptionally racist, exceptionally violent towards women. We had games like Custer's Revenge on the field right now, where the object of which game was to rape an Indigenous woman. So just an egregious space. And the fact that we have women like Skawanati and Todd putting themselves at risk to clear these spaces is something that I think is exceptionally important to all the research that I'm able to do. And so trying to clear a space where artists like that can have their voices heard now in a larger community, and we can enter it into a larger discourse of new media that has largely forgotten the contributions that people of color and women and Indigenous people are making to the field.
Right on. Okay, well then let's get down to the heart of it about what are we talking about then when we're speaking about Indigenous new media and digital storytelling? Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to kind of consider trying to problematize those terms about what is new about new media and what is media even, right? I'm thinking about some of the work like Angela Haas did about starting to talk about wampum as hypertext and things like that. So mm-hmm. can you talk about that a little, about how the different ways that we could kind of start to critically unpack these terms and the way that they've been naturalized to mean specific things?
Right. Well, I'm a critic of the term new media, mostly because I see it as a modernist conceit, which actually in many ways can contribute to the elision of the voices of people of color, indigenous peoples to that field. New, the modernist idea of new, has always been about clearing the table, finding this new space from which to speak. And it has always been historically been tied to this idea that we are beginning again, that there is these new spaces to speak about race and gender that will not be under the old oppressive regime of the old. And that always sort of has traditionally just sort of recoded and repatriated old colonial ideologies within that space just by sort of steamrolling them under the idea of the new. So I think a much more critical way to deal with new media is through what's called remediation theory, which really is sort of a critical unpacking of what new media is that looks at it through an idea of a genealogy. So that it is not this new media that just sort of arises out of nowhere that one morning I woke up and got on Facebook. It is looking at how there is a long, long history of media that all has arrived in this moment. So, and that's not just with the internet, but we can look at it in lots of different ways. So when television and movies first started, what they were doing was essentially remediating theater. And you can go back and watch television and see how this works, right? It's single-shot camera. It's people who are actually exiting stage left and stage right. It was really putting a camera in front of theater. And this was not only because people didn't know how to work within this media, but also because audiences respond to what they know. New media just will not catch on unless there's a handle for somebody. And we see this with the internet. I mean, look at YouTube. YouTube is a remediation of television. Mm. It is not a new idea. Again, I think what remediation theory forgets and where we can interject as scholars of indigenous new media is that remediation theory, of course, like the majority of Western theory, works specifically off the Western episteme and elides all other contributions. So remediation theory always starts with Descartes and linear perspective, Albertini and the vanishing point, and then sort of moves on from there. What I think indigenous new media brings to the table is the fact that I'm going to start with what I think perhaps is a definition of new media, or the one that I sort of hold to, is this idea of new media is based in interactivity. So the fact that we are not just passive recipients of culture, but we're also producers of culture. So whether we're just creating little avatars to go in our instant message chat or on our Facebook page, we are complicit in the acts of construction. And new media scholars, particularly Marxist scholars, get very excited about this sort of thing, right? Because the means of production is being upset. And I take great stake in the fact that we are able to be producers in that field. But I think why some people get so excited about this part of new media theory is because they're coming from a very Western, liberal, Lockean idea of media where it's all very individualistic. It comes from this very certain idea of the text and that one-to-one interaction with the text. And now with certainly when hypertext was a thing, white dudes were so excited, like, look at this text that's interactive. It spills beyond the limits of the text. I think what indigenous new media, what that forgets is that indigenous medias have been doing that sort of thing for such a long, long time. And Haas's article, Wampum as Hypertext, is such a great example of how these new medias, and I'm using my radio scare quotes there, are such an important part of many different indigenous cultures that stretch back so far into things like the wampum and certainly into oral traditions where discourses of authorship are much more fluid and dynamic and interactive than in the Western tradition. So starting looking from those perspectives, I think actually indigenous critical theory can bring quite a lot to what new media is and what it thinks it's doing in this moment, not by looking at it in the new, but by moving backwards and considering what how these things have unfolded in the past.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, so my next question kind of surrounds another term that I think is important to start to unpack, and it revolves around the notion of sovereignty, which is really critical within indigenous studies as a whole. And so my question surrounding that is that oftentimes when we're talking about sovereignty, we tend to think of it in terms of macro level, state produced, institutionalized. And so I want to kind of ask you about what you think new media studies and media studies have to offer folks wanting to try to complicate the notion of sovereignty. And I'm thinking here about the notion of visual sovereignty and different multiple levels and scales that sovereignty can be enacted through indigenous new media. So maybe you could elaborate a little on that.
Yeah, no, it's a great and important question. And my initial answer to that is that I think we always need to think of sovereignty and self-determination as coterminous. And so that my point of access as someone who works in media studies, who has a degree, has multiple degrees in literature, is then what do the arts, what does new media bring to these conversations of sovereignty? And that is the fact that it is difficult to think of sovereignty without the element of self-determination. And that is because settler colonial ideology has always been about appropriating representation and giving it back to indigenous peoples in order to rend them of sovereignty. So early representations of indigenous people, the Vanishing Indian, for one, was used as a way to attract settlers to Canada. The CPR, the Canadian Railway, actually had a marketing campaign where the Vanishing Indians come and see them before they leave. So creating an ideology of terra nullius within representation in the culture that actually contributes to the dissimulation of sovereignty. So unless we understand the really close relationship between representation in large and sovereignty, I don't think we can really understand the full impact, the full insidious nature of what settler colonialism does. So when we're talking about like Jolene Rickard's notion of visual sovereignty that Kristen Dowell also unpacks in interesting ways, we are in a lot of ways talking about the reclamation of self-representation by indigenous peoples, or in a lot of senses, the remediation or remix of indigenous identity. So I think a great example, a really popular example right now, is A Tribe Called Red, which is recuperating Hollywood images of indigenous people that were initially created by white people, and a lot of people have white people red-facing, and reincorporating that into a different representation on which they set the terms. And it is, in my view, by setting the terms of self-representation and giving it an indigenous people's finding spaces to self-represent, which new media is proving to be a vital space to do that, that we can also begin to claim new ideas of around sovereignty and land, in which new media is the basis or the entry point into those conversations.
Great. That gives us a lot to think about. Maybe this would be a good time to throw to a song.
All right. We'll now be playing From Another World by Starry Skies.
My love times are coming. You notice it in the strumming. Notice it in the
Treasons Radio. This is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rocking with the best. 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Wells, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway. Oh, Dave, I like your shave.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Hello, and welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Hope you're having a good Monday morning. If you are just tuning in, we are listening to an interview with Kaylin Barr and David Gardner, who is a professor from the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program here at UBC around Indigenous new media and futurisms. And if you heard the song that we played, that was called From Another World by Silver Jackson. So, please, gentlemen, we are at your beck and call.
Okay. Let's get back to it then. Okay, well, now that we've kind of tackled some concepts, some large concepts like the Western episteme and sovereignty, I think I'd like to start to talk about one of the largest concepts within Indigenous studies, and that's the issue of land. Mm. And so, within new media studies, I think within a Western kind of media study context, there's often a dominant discourse which circulates around how emergent technologies like the internet and social media and things can be seen as ways that actually further alienate us from land, from an embodied sense of place. So the question that I have here is then, is this idea one of the reasons we see resistance to a specifically indigenous, again, radio scare quotes, new media? And what are some projects that you see, some indigenous media projects you see, which challenge that kind of dominant discourse about media being always alienating us further from an embodied sense of place?
Mm. Yeah, no, thanks, Kaylin. I think that's a really important question. It's certainly one that is central to the research that I'm doing now, because I think from the beginning, and this is less so the case, but certainly from the beginning, cyberspace has been coded as a landless territory, that it was this utopic, otherworldly space that was going to remove us from this terrestrial terrain. And Loretta Todd makes some really, her article, Aboriginal Narratives in Cyberspace, makes a really fundamental intervention into this ideology. Again, sort of showing the genealogy of this type of history and taking it back to Plato and the allegory of the caves and the idea that the internet was really just an extension of that. It was a way for people to separate themselves from the material world, particularly in a time when we see the material world beginning to crumble around us, when we see in science fiction movies all these apocalypse narratives or these future, these space alien narratives where the world is going to be destroyed and there is this anxiety about where will we go. And that answer to that, one way of configuring or thinking about the internet is looking at the internet as one of those spaces. This is an idea that authors like William Gibson and Neal Stephenson have played with, right? Where we, a very sort of Cartesian idea of separating our mind out of our bodies to live within the wires of the internet. And we should rightly be suspicious of that, particularly as students of critical indigenous studies, of indigenous new media, is that how can we reconfigure, and this is a question that Todd asked as well, is how can we reconfigure new media as a responsible way to think about our not just our connection to land, but our connection to our bodies? And that raises really important questions about race, gender, ability. So the work that I've been reaching out towards or that I've been trying to unpack in further detail is the work that really tries to achieve new connections to land, that in fact puts into reverse this idea that cyberspace is a landless territory. So one of, I think, my favorites for that, one that I really love to teach and write about, and we've worked on this together, is Helamia Sparrow's Ashes on the Water. So Sparrow is Musqueam, so from this community, and she is an author, a actor, and a screenwriter. And Ashes on the Water is a pod play. Pod plays were developed for the Push Festival. I guess here's a good plug for the Push Festival while we're on it, going on right now. And they are a set of interactive online pieces of theater, experimental theater, that you download onto your phone and then go to a specific place on the land. You hit play on your mobile device, and then you are guided through that land while a story is layered over top of your movement. And Ashes on the Water tells the story of the Squamish Women's Paddle Song and the history of that, and really sort of takes you back in time to another period, not a pre-contact period, but in a period when we're thinking about when the relationships between indigenous peoples and settlers was perhaps more present, certainly was more present than it is currently in that space of Crab Beach. So essentially what Sparrow was able to do is to bring that conception of the land and our engagement with it and in a way augment our experience with lived reality, our bodies, the land with us, and give us new understanding of that space. I know you've also written on this piece, Kaylin. Is there anything you want to add about Sparrow? Or?
Yeah, like I think Sparrow's piece is a really beautiful idea of like, yes, what you kind of just touched on there, something that you introduced to me through the class, is the notion that we can stop thinking about things, cyberspace as a place of virtual reality, and we start to think about it as a place of augmented reality. Place the technologies that then bring us closer and like into contact with the land. And I feel like that's what that piece does. That piece takes you, puts you in a very specific place, reminds you of those histories, reminds you of all of the events and structures that have kind of come together to form the city of Vancouver as we know it, as we think we know it. And it shows those kind of histories that have been invisibilized, and yeah, and importantly puts you back onto place and makes you also like you're kind of mentioning before, cognizant of your body in space. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of that piece, and so I think it's a really beautiful piece and a really amazing example of what augmented reality can do and how it can challenge that discourse around technologies being strictly alienating and strictly taking us away from an embodied notion of place.
Mm-hmm. I thought one of my favorite moments from teaching that piece was in our class last term when we were sort of talking, and I believe you were presenting on it, this moment where you're standing by the water at the end, and there's the lapping of the water in the piece, and you're also on the beach in front of the water, and the lapping of the water on the material shore, and there was this fundamental blurring for people of those two spaces. So Sparrow was able to really layer those spaces in a really interesting way, where it become the technology and the land become indistinguishable in a lot of ways, and not ways that are eliding history or culture, but in ways that make you much more present in that moment. And I think it's a really fascinating and beautiful point to reflect on how those technologies can work.
Yeah, those beautiful confluences. Mm-hmm, like that was an important moment for me you see a real blurring but in a positive way, like you're saying, where the histories aren't erased and the stories aren't erased and explicit recognition of where you are is not erased. It's actually augmented and brought to your attention, and you become aware of it in like kind of important ways.
Right. And it's another Sparrow's piece is another great instance of remediation as well, right? That this, the Women's Paddle Song has been an important song, important story in this community, in Coast Salish communities, for a long time. It's not a story that was erased by any means. It still has a long and important history. But what Sparrow is able to do is to write it into another medium and to then proliferate it in different ways and to bring it to different audiences through the Push Festival. So again, it's bringing tradition, I'll use the scare quotes there, into bear on new media and really show the confluence of those two ideas and how they can work so well together and the possibilities of making them work well together. I'll put in a plug for Pod Plays and Sparrow as well while I'm here. If you're interested in that piece, you can go to New World Theater and check out Pod Plays by them. That one's called Ashes on the Water. They're available. You can just write them and you get them for $5. So if you're living in Vancouver, if you know Crab Beach and would like to have a more rich understanding of the colonial, the very fraught and deep running colonial histories of that space, I would certainly recommend supporting independent theater and also having a great experience with some fantastic new media that's coming out of the city.
Okay, so I think I'll shift gears here to something that you've begun to touch upon, which is the notion of futurisms and science fiction. And I've in my research and studies, I've really seen a kind of a strong move towards a specifically indigenous science fiction. And I my question then surrounds, how do you understand, could you kind of explain to us a little about how you understand indigenous futurisms and what indigenous futurisms and an indigenized, scare quotes, science fiction offer a project of decolonization?
I think first and foremost for indigenous futurisms is that science fiction and fantasy allow what Daniel Justice calls spaces to imagine otherwise. And I think that is an important piece of resistance against the colonial ideology, which has created very bleak futures that are, according to those policies, bereft of indigenous people, that where the vanishing Indian has finally come to fruition and there are no indigenous bodies within those spaces. What indigenous futurisms does is not only to write indigenous peoples into those spaces, but to show the fundamental contributions that indigenous knowledges can make to the continuation of the human race. So I'm thinking of people like Nanaba Becker, and her fantastic short film, The Sixth World, which engages the fact that we have indigenous peoples, Navajo people, traveling to Mars to colonize Mars, which raises interesting problems in itself that we've talked about in different venues. But the fundamental technology, what's going to allow that mission to succeed, is traditions around how the Navajo community harvests and grows corn. So that technology is what is going to allow for that future. So again, not only just providing a space where indigenous peoples exist and interrupting that ideology, a colonial ideology of assimilation erasure, but also showing how the futures might only exist if supported by indigenous futures in those ways.
And I think another draw for me is when I start to think about it, is that science fiction itself as a genre has been like oftentimes like a barely concealed narrative of colonization and colonialism. And I think that that's why an indigenous science fiction kind of represents a critical intervention and a disrupting of those narratives of different ways that we could think about that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't, there is, I'm not the, certainly by no means the only person to say this, but we, there is no science fiction without colonization, right? Science fiction is the history of colonization. And so it's important first just to recognize and to lay bare those tropes, and then to think of ways in which those tropes can be indigenized and rethought. Grace Dillon is doing some amazing work in these regards, where she's not just she's a great supporter of indigenous science fiction writers, and you can read her book Walking on the Clouds, which looks at how indigenous peoples have been writing science fiction for a long, long time. That this is, again, this is not a new thing, that this is a thing that's been going on in indigenous cultures for a long time. And she has collected a lot of those stories together to sort of show the trajectory. But what she's also doing, and what I love about her work, is she's also going into the non-indigenous canon, the really strict, hardcore, what has been the Western idea of science fiction, and she's doing indigenized readings of those texts. So she's going into Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, and looking at how Bradbury is relying on tropes of indigeneity, and how he, in fact, might have been using tropes of indigeneity in ways that can support resistance against colonial metaphors. Looking at how authors like Bradbury, Bradbury's the only one that's coming to mind for me right now for some reason, but that these authors have traditionally, science fiction authors have traditionally been, have traditionally leaned towards the political left, have been resistant to the state majority, have been supportive of queer, trans issues, and how that they can be recuperated towards indigenous understandings and knowledges. And so the way that Dillon is able to rethink and reread those pieces, I think, is another important contribution of where the field is going.
Yeah, and I think about some kind of critical interventions into media studies before. I think it was Faye Ginsburg talking about how that indigenous artists and media makers have always been there at the start of that. Like, she talks about the work of Inuit filmmakers on Nanuk of the North, mm-hmm. and the fact that, like, this isn't a new thing, that those people have been written out, right? It's not like this is an emergent phenomenon. And I also think about the Speaking the Language of Spiders piece that you introduced us to. Like, at the very start of, like, new media art practices, we see indigenous artists. Right. They're there. It's just been obscured.
And fundamentally, too, maybe even more to the point, is that indigenous labor, right? That this is, cyberspace has a way of eliding labor and pretending that this is a thing that exists somehow just as this perfect moment. And certainly in Nanuk of the North, that labor is elided entirely. Photography in the same way. Media has always, since the beginning, been a way to capture indigenous culture, the dying indigenous culture as well. So just one that came to mind when you were saying that, Kaylin, is Lisa Nakamura also has a really important piece on how Navajo women were hired to weave the initial circuit boards for or microchips for the first personal computers on Navajo territory. So the first time we get personal computers in our house, more than likely those microchips were woven by indigenous people on indigenous territory. Mm-hmm. And that is another history that's sort of been elided out of there. So again, these histories, we can go really far back and look at how indigenous peoples have been contributing to this history for a long time. And I think it's an important part of sort of interrupting this narrative where we have a lot of people sort of being like, wow, look at indigenous people suddenly doing this on new media. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the contributions that indigenous peoples have been making since the beginning, right on the basis of the material of the computer itself. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's talk video games then. So you're just telling us that you're going to be on a panel about the video game Never Alone. I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. So this is a panel that I've been thinking about with my colleague Warren Carew, who's at the University of Manitoba. We both incorporated Never Alone into our syllabi. Warren teaches Indigenous literatures at the University of Manitoba and is stepping into the idea of bringing games into that space. And I've been working with games for a little while as well, mostly in my new media class, though. So now I'm introducing it into some of my lower level classes, my 220 Indigenous representation. And so this is a panel that, and for those of you who don't know, Never Alone is a video game that was done in very strict and very rigorous consultation with the Cook Island. Is it the Cook Island Tribal Council? Yes, I believe. The Cook Island Tribal Council, so an Indigenous group, in producing a game that they felt adequately represented their cultures in over 3,000 years of storytelling. It's a really powerful, beautifully designed side-scroller, which takes you on the adventures of a young girl and her fox as they travel through an icy landscape. And as you move, you also learn through videos about the history of those peoples. It's a beautifully done game, and it's groundbreaking in a lot of different ways. And part of what it does is really highlight the intersections between storytelling and digital technologies. So if you watch the trailer for the piece, the master storyteller, who's the elder who narrates the story as we go along, says, "What are the use of stories if we can't share them?" And really, I read that as a way of sort of offhandedly saying, well, why wouldn't we share these stories through digital technologies? Wouldn't Indigenous communities be taking up these traditions in order to share these important stories that are important for a very large community? The struggle, I think, right now, as I see it, is, first of all, is I think this game is a vital space of storytelling and can really, not just because games are hot and that students will like them, although they do, and it is a fun space to teach, but because they're doing storytelling in a really exciting way, that we could actually even in some ways strip the digital platform away from and still would be important. But the trick is that lots of profs, lots of instructors are still really worried about teaching video games in the classroom, and rightly so. Like, how the hell do you do it? Like, how do you do a close reading of a video game when you spend 2 hours trying to jump over a gap and keep falling? Or you have to, like, lead students. I've already been leading students just through installing that software. So a lot of it is just the basic roadblocks that we run into. So the panel is about not just the pedagogy of teaching video games and how we can bring them into the classroom and how we can encourage other instructors to do it, but also showing the tools that we can use to unpack and read this. So using things like visual culture to read through that, using performance studies, using critical Indigenous studies, and showing people that we already have tools available that can be very readily applied to these spaces to do really critical, interesting, and rigorous readings that add a lot to the field of Indigenous literature and Indigenous studies. So that's, I know I've take a little bit of flack from people like Elizabeth LaPonce, who's an amazing Indigenous video game designer. She's like, everybody's talking about Never Alone. Like, come on. There's other Indigenous video games out there. And I agree. There's tons. Elizabeth herself does so many. But Never Alone has just been this cultural bedrock at the moment. It's in the zeitgeist. So I think it's a good place to sort of start to get some of the people who are really just committed to text, plain and simple, to start to think about the possibilities in this classroom. So that's what we're going to try and unpack when we get there.
Yeah, and it elicits conversation, right? Like last week we had an episode about The Revenant where we talked about certain problems that we had with it or certain strengths that it had, but it started a conversation. And I definitely think it's important, to bear in mind, like you're saying, that there's all sorts of pedagogical difficulties that come with like teaching video games, but that those difficulties arise with all forms of media, right? With text as well, and or also teaching films, right? It's just we've come to expect those difficulties to arise, and we've come to found ways to negotiate, and there's no reason that we can't find ways to negotiate something like a video game as well, right? And that we shouldn't have an inherent conservatism around well, students want to see this. You know, right. We can't give them what they want. This is what they want to learn. You
heaven
know?
Forbid like, that they have yeah, fun in yeah, one of our classrooms.
Exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, no, I am all for finding, and that's a lot of the work that I do here, and what I sort of see my contribution to the academy is sort of clearing spaces for things, digital objects that have often been treated as unacademic or uncritical, and giving people the tools to see those in a critical light and to unpack them and add them to their repertoire, of particular when we're talking about decolonization or resistance or resurgence, and how new digital medias can contribute that to that without overshadowing the super important work that's going on by our colleagues who are working in land pedagogy and working in gender. How these things, there's a confluence of these ideas in new media that we can bring to the field and in fact help to think about them in larger and different ways.
Right on. Okay, well, maybe this is a time to give ourselves a break and throw to another song.
More real than most of us believe. The spirit world is everything.
Welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. You are listening to CATR 101.9 FM. Happy Monday. You just listened to Sidestep by Boogie the Beat, which is It's another, if you like Tribe Called Red, then that's another band you can listen to. They're just great. If you're just tuning in, you're catching the end of an interview that Kaylin Barr is doing right now with Professor David Gertner, who's in the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program. They've been talking about new media and futurisms. They were just talking about Indigenous video games, and now they're going to wrap up the interview.
Okay, so I think we only have about time for one more question, so I'd like to bring it back to where we are and ask a question about radio. Now, radio, I feel like radio is often seen as a technology which doesn't fit into this, like, putatively new media framework. So my question then is, how do you see radio fitting into new media studies, and what makes it so special, and why does it continue to resonate, even though we can see it as somewhat of an older technology?
Yeah, good question. And I've got a couple things I want to say about that. I think the first, I'll speak to the why is it so resonant? And this, I'm thinking of what my colleague Mark Turin has said on this that I found sort of stuck with me, is that radio is one of the only medias, if not the only media, that you can imbibe while doing something else. So you can be, you know, doing the dishes, watching the kids, driving the car. So it is this media that can be on in the background, really becomes a really permanent and present part of people's lives. Like, I grew up with the CBC was just on all the time. Like, the radio was just there. And those links make it a really powerful political tool as well, that we see. In places where, like Rwanda, where the radio became a way to really mobilize the masses in a community in really negative ways, ways that need to be challenged, and also ways, and a lot of positive ways, that also helped to save lives. Radio is, I guess, considered to be one of the older medias, but I think we're seeing right now is a resurgence of radio, and certainly a remediation of radio in the podcast. Podcasting has become one of the major forms of media right now. This can be sort of demonstrated by capitalism alone. If you look or you listen to any podcast now, all of a sudden we have, you know, Pepsi, we have airlines getting in, they are putting their advertisements in there. It's almost as sort of this leftist space untouched by late capitalism. It's kind of losing its cachet there. But we can see how popular it's becoming by the media dollars that are going into it. But that aside for the moment, I think what makes podcasting and radio still so important is this idea that you can do something else. But it's also the intimacy of the medium as well, too. It's the fact that these are, quite often you're listening to these things with headphones plugged right into your head. It is this very intimate connection, conversation with somebody that I don't think you experience in a lot of other places. So for that means alone, because of the intimacy of it, I think there is a lot of potential there for new forms of thinking about representation. And the Sparrow piece is a great example of that, right? Is how that intimacy can transform your relationship to time and space in that setting when properly manipulated. I'm rambling a bit there, so.
That's good. That's great. I think that's all we have time for, though. But, yeah, I just want to say thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
No, it's really been my pleasure. I'm so glad to see Unceded Airways doing such great work, and to see you guys bringing in so much important stuff for CITR and the UBC community. So thank you.
All right. Thanks again, David, for coming on the show, and Kaylin for taking on that interview. I was really interested, so I can only imagine how into it the rest of you were. Thank you for tuning in. I'm just going to go forward with some plugs for some community events that are happening this week. And next, I want to remind you that NISCA New Year, the Hobie celebration, is happening this weekend at the P&E, February 6th and 5th. We have Restorative Justice in Your Community, which is happening tomorrow at 6:30 at the North Shore Restorative Justice Society in the North Shore. Lindsay LaChance, who is doing her PhD with FNIS and the Theater Studies Department, is going to be facilitating a discussion about playwright Monique Mojica. And this is happening at the Audane Gallery from 6 until 8 this coming Wednesday. And then this coming Thursday from 6 to 9, Kwiatztemowth, the Squamish Language Group, will be hosting an event called How to Learn an Indigenous Language at SFU Woodwards. And that'll be happening downtown Vancouver again. That is Thursday from 6 to 9. So thank you again.
Can I just put in a quick
plug?
Oh,
yes, you can.
And also FNIS will be hosting Val Napoleon coming up. She's giving a talk called Creating Reconciliation Law Stories for Our Grandchildren. That's going to be on February the 5th in the Liu Institute from 10 to 12 p.m. It's open to everybody. There's going to be snacks available. And if you haven't seen Val talk or read her work, she's a fantastic, amazing scholar, and it's sure to be a wonderful conversation. So I hope some of you can make it out to that as well.
Nice. Okay, well, thank you again, Kaylin and David. Haichka OCM, thank you for listening. Please enjoy the rest of your Monday. Look out for those events that I mentioned, and tune in next week.
This ad caught your attention. It also caught the attention of the coolest people from Squamish to Bellingham. Music fans, students, and members of various cultural communities. If you want your ad to do the same, advertise with CITR and Discorder. If you've got a rad new ad or just something you want to share, whether in print, on air, or online, promote your wares, services, or events with us. Contact us at advertising@CITR.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit CITR.ca for rates, information, and packages. This is the end of our ad, and if you're still here, we must be doing something right.
Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.